The history behind the American retreat and defeat in Afghanistan. This is as current as it comes, and I knew last week that we had to be tackling this and been working on researching and right up to the last hour getting more information on what's going on, reports from friends, contacts, missionaries, soldiers, others involved. We need to remember that Britain was involved in three wars in Afghanistan back in 1830s, 1840s, back in the 1880s, and even in 1819, there was a war between Britain and Afghanistan. But Britain learned, you go into Afghanistan, do what you've got to do, and you get out fast, because the longer you stay in there, the worse it gets. Britain could win short-term victories there, the greatest empire in the world at that time. New Afghanistan's not a place you occupy, it's a place where if you've got to go in for punitive raid or whatever, do it and then get out. Because Afghanistan has been the graveyard of empires, they say. It's extremely rugged, tough, mountainous terrain. Logistically, it's a nightmare for any occupying force, as the Soviets found out as well. In 1979, just before Christmas, or actually on Christmas Day, the Soviet Red Army invaded Afghanistan, and they were there for a whole 10 years, only half the amount of time that America's been there, and America's been there longer than the British and the Soviets combined, 20 years. Well, the Soviets went in, and here's some nice propaganda art made by the Red Army of how they would like it to have been, but I'm sure it was absolute hell for them, and in fact, many of the Russians said that Afghanistan was Russia's Vietnam. What America experienced in Vietnam, Russia got in Afghanistan. And just like the Soviets were arming the North Vietnamese to use against Americans, so America was arming the Afghans with Stinger missiles, for example, to take out Russian Hind helicopter gunships and so on. And so, after 10 years of catastrophic frustration in Afghanistan, the Soviets left. And there are graveyards of Soviet tanks, memoirs of the Cold War littering Afghanistan, just reminding and providing lessons which you would have thought the US Army would have learned when they went in there in 2001. America ventured in the aftermath of 9/11, and in fact, there's some good reason for at least some of us to be grateful for that, because there are two American missionaries in Afghanistan that some under sentence of death, awaiting death by firing squad at the hand of the Taliban. Heather Mercer and her friend Donna Rice were there. They were, in fact, Heather Mercer's been a guest here on the mission, taking devotions on abortion. She was, along with her friend, sentenced to death for showing the Jesus form to four Afghans on her laptop. And so, if it wasn't for America's invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, she would have been shot in the head, as would her co-worker, and that would have been the end of it. But they did get rescued. So some good was done in crushing Al-Qaeda and the Taliban back in 2001, and America went in, and they were actually well received initially, but it didn't stay that way when they stayed or outstayed their welcome. When they started, now, I've got a nephew, or I should say my wife's got a nephew, who served in the US Marines in Afghanistan on several tours of duty, and quite a few friends, including someone who's a co-missionary of mine. In fact, a couple of people have been missionaries of ours, have served in Afghanistan and have been involved in the war there as well. So I've got input from South Africans who've been on the ground in there too. It began as a war against terrorism. Their mission was clear. Target Al-Qaeda, who was the prime suspect in being behind the 9/11 attacks, according to the popular understanding at that time, and the Taliban in Afghanistan, who was supporting them. By the way, the Taliban in Afghanistan were so bad that only three countries in the world recognized their government, one of which was Sudan. Shows you how bad Sudan under Omar al-Bashir was. But the war against terrorism quickly changed into nation building, whatever that is. And before you knew it, they were promoting radical feminism, which went down like a lead balloon in Afghanistan. And then the LGBTQI plus, multiplied, affinity, whatever, gay agenda, and gender confusion. And then For example, some individual ordered the flying of the rainbow flag from the US Embassy in Kabul in June of this year. So many Afghans who had welcomed the Americans as liberators in 2001 grew to resent the promotion of immorality and perversion. They were well welcomed. There were a lot of people extremely grateful for America coming in at first, because the Taliban were really bad and the Americans were very nice. But once they started to push this development of national working strategy for civil society, what has this got to do with fighting terrorism and promoting embrace diversity and end discrimination? Didn't go down too well. Women's lib didn't work too well in Afghanistan either. And in 2008, American troops confiscated and threw away and burned Bibles at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. CNN News, and the Bibles were written in Pashto and Dari languages, and the Defense Department was concerned the books might somehow be used to convert Afghans. Well, I'm sure that was the intention. These Bibles were sent by folks back home to their members who were soldiers in Afghanistan to be able to give to some of the local people. It's something we did all the time in Southwest Africa and Angola. South Ghanami is the biggest single purchaser of Bibles from the Bible Society. Bible Society had to rapidly downsize when the SADF ended conscription, because they were the main beneficiary of all the tithes, the voluntary tithes automatically deducted from everyone's salaries when we were in the Defense Force. And the SADF bought Bibles. We took Bibles in on operations and left them with the villagers in Angola. So I'm sure there were people in America who thought that being a Christian country involved in what George Bush had called a crusade, that was the term he used initially, against terrorism, sending Bibles to Afghanistan was a good idea. You would have thought, but you'd have been wrong. The incident became public knowledge in 2011, and Lieutenant Colonel Mark Wright told CNN that such religious outreach could endanger American troops and civilians because Afghanistan is a devoutly Muslim country. But there's another reason the Bibles were confiscated. Military rules forbid troops from proselytizing in the country. For those who don't know what proselytizing means, what they talk about is evangelizing. They forbade their troops from evangelizing in the country. And this seems absolutely insane. You expect soldiers to risk their lives to fight terrorism, and they can't use the best thing anyone can give, the greatest book ever written, the best antidote to terrorism imaginable, the only long-term solution to all the world's problems on every level that you want to talk about, not just security and survival and fighting terrorism. But why not just collect the Bibles and send them back to the same church that sent them to the United States? And the military admitted in this interview with CNN that they had considered doing that, but they were worried that the church might send them to another organization in Afghanistan, and that might give the impression that Bibles were being distributed by the US government. I mean, selling phosphorus bombs to Israel and carpet bombing civilians, that's fine. But distributing Bibles, I mean, gee, what would people think of America if, you know, aside from dropping atomic bombs on cities, which just happened to be the main concentration of Christians in Japan, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, which wiped out the biggest churches and the main Christian concentrations in university cities. You know, that's fine, but distributing Bibles in Afghanistan, I mean, what would people think of America? So they burned them. And when they were asked, why did you burn the Bibles instead of just throwing away, they said, it is US military policy to burn our trash. Now imagine if they'd used that terminology about the Quran. We burned the trash. Do you think, and the response of the government, which was then under Obama in 2009, was absolutely nothing except no apologies. They fall over themselves to apologize for someone who wasn't even employed by the American government for producing a video somewhere down in Florida that apparently offended some Muslims. And yet they couldn't apologize for confiscating Bibles sent by churches to their own members in Afghanistan. Now, you kind of wonder why God might be not on our side or supporting us at these times. Just think of these sort of events. Now, the month of June is recognized as LGBTQI whatever Pride Month, and the United States respects the dignity and equality of LGBTI people and celebrates the contribution of society. This, by the way, I'm reading straight from the US State Department. We remain committed to supporting civil rights of minorities, but apparently not Christians. but it included LGBT people. So remember, you can't have barbers in Afghanistan because that might offend the Muslims, because they're a highly Muslim country, very serious religious country. But you don't think the LGBTQ month could offend somebody? They literally flew the rainbow flag from the US Embassy in Kabul. One of President Biden's earliest initiatives after taking office was to send the State Department a strongly worded memo to ensure that the United States diplomacy and foreign assistance promote and protect the human rights of LGBTQI plus persons. I don't know, they keep adding stuff there. It's hard to keep up with it. Apparently, don't worry about Christians being persecuted, the most persecuted people on the planet. That's not a problem, but the LGBTQ, they need support. And I can imagine this went down like a lead balloon amongst the deeply religious Afghan Muslim people. President Biden even described LGBTQI plus as one of our most dearly held values. In case you missed it, they light up the White House in these colors. Not that there's anything wrong with these colors. It belongs to the rainbow, and Ark Encounter, Aunts and Jess are reclaiming, saying, perverts don't own the rainbow. Rainbow is a biblical one. Nothing wrong with the rainbow. We should take it back for ourselves. But we know that's not their message. They're not trying to remember Noah, the flood, the ark. That's not what they're trying to do here. They're trying to promote perversion, actually. This is a picture of an LGBTQ flag flying over an American military base. Actually, I believe it's Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. When the US president proclaimed June as Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, and Queer Pride Month, he declared proudly, nearly 14% of my 1,500 agency appointees identify as LGBTQ+. Well, I'm sure that must have excited the Afghan people no end. He gave special shout-out to Secretary Pete and Rachel Levine, this is Rachel Levine, the first openly transgender person to be confirmed by the Senate, quoting from President Biden. I'm using the word president loosely in inverted commas, italics with a small p. No wonder the acting US ambassador in Kabul believed that in-your-face defiance of Islamic values was the best way to promote respect for America in the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. I'm sure this sort of thing must have had the people really cheering in the aisles. But how many Afghan soldiers saw the rainbow flag flying over the $800 million US embassy, which is now abandoned, and said, I'm proud we're fighting shoulder to shoulder with Joe Biden's gays? Probably none. Probably many Afghans regarded this as just one step short of treading on a copy of the Quran or burning a Quran. Honestly, why does America think they've gone from being welcomed as liberators in 2001 to being despised now? Well, look no further than moving from fighting terrorism to promoting perversion. And now these people are being abandoned to the Taliban. The Taliban are rejoicing, and boy, have they been re-equipped. Afghanistan is only the latest in a long line of American allies betrayed. I mean, when this happened, this just sent off a chain reaction in my mind, going through books I've read, people I've met, experiences I've had going back from Rhodesia all the way through, because this is deja vu. We have seen this before. As recently as the 8th of July, American President Biden was adamant that the Taliban would not be able to overrun Afghanistan because Kabul had a well-funded and well-trained military. No jokes. Billions, hundreds of billions of dollars America's poured into training the Afghan National Army. The Afghan troops of 300,000 are well-equipped, said Biden. As well-equipped as any army in the world. And an air force, something against something like 75,000 Taliban. It's not inevitable. I trust the capacity to the Afghan military, who is better trained, better equipped, and more competent in terms of conducting war. Now, all that may be true, but better trained, better equipped, and more competent does not equal more dedicated. And fact is, the Afghan Taliban have proven to be far more dedicated than the Afghan National Army, who apparently were fighting for money more than for conviction, because many of them just faded away. It took the Taliban only 5 weeks to prove Biden wrong and to expose the hypocrisy of America's 20 years of constructive engagement in Afghanistan. At the time in 2001, I chaired when the US military went into Afghanistan, because I knew, amongst other things, was rescuing these two American missionaries who I knew were about to be shot, and it was literally at the last minute, in came Navy SEALs, rescued them. And Heather Mercer's testimony, she told us right here in our boardroom, as she got on the plane, and they being chinooked out in this big helicopter, the team leader passed the satellite phone over to her, and it was George Bush on the phone to speak to her. First person met when landed, George W. Bush, welcome. And she said, you know, I didn't see him as the president, I saw him as a brother in Christ, who's deeply concerned for us in our mission. And Heather Mercer's testimony, we've got the books in our library, well worth reading. But it became hypocrisy. Once they moved from fighting terrorism to turning the people to a bunch of perverts and multiplying the numbers of brothels in Baghdad, in, well, not just Baghdad, but in Kabul and Kandahar, what on earth were the people doing there? And when you count the cost, it's not just American soldiers who've died by the thousands. It's not just the government who have fled, or at least the president's fled. And you've got this General Milley who's been saying that the biggest threat to America is not the Taliban, but the biggest threat to America is homeschooled conservative Christians and all of that. You know, they're the real threat to America. And so the real threat are people who wear MAGA hats. Yep, we know there's some people around here who have those red hats. He thinks Taliban's not a problem. Wearing a turban's not a problem. That's people with those red hats, with MAGA, Make America Great Again. They're the threat. How many billions of dollars did the US pour into Afghanistan? Well, I'm told it's over $1 trillion. And the cost of the war. Notice it didn't take that many troops initially, because, you know, and it went down because initially the people were just, yay, welcome, and thank you. But when you outstay your welcome, you go from being a liberator to being an occupier. And after a while, you become an oppressor. I mean, you're the one with the roadblocks. And that's, it's, if you've got to go, and I said at the time to my American friends, and on radio and public news around America in 2001 already, get out fast. That's what you learn from the British. That's what you should have learned from the Soviets as well. You can't occupy Afghanistan. The people are very nationalist. It doesn't matter how much I hate the Taliban, they hate foreign occupiers even more after a while. You know, be a liberator, do what you've got to do, get back home and, you know, have the bands playing and flags waving and wave your hands to go onto the plane and then get out of there. And the Afghans will write you into the history books as liberators and friends. But you stay too long and you become an oppressor. And they needed more and more and more troops, and the cost of the war just kept getting on the longer they stayed. But no longer were they fighting terrorism, they were now involved in nation building, whatever that is. How many American soldiers and other allied forces were injured, crippled, or died in that two-decade war? And I don't have the full stats, but a lot of Americans died there, and many, many more were crippled. And for what? This statistic, I think, is probably a bit short. US soldiers, 20,000 wounded. Remember, many of those would be crippled. I have seen American women in airport terminals walk around with obviously metal legs and things like that, or missing arms. And it's horrible enough to see men have been crippled like that, but to see women, because, you know, people like Clinton and Obama, who never served in the army, they shipped women into combat. And having your legs and arms blown off just isn't right. 2,300 US soldiers killed officially. By the way, not one American soldier was killed in the last 18 months in Afghanistan. In fact, the last 10 years they haven't been involved in combat, they've been involved in advisory and support, logistical sides, and the Afghan soldiers have been doing the fighting. But Afghan civilians, they say 100,000 killed. I'm sure it's a lot more than that. 2 million refugees. Well, now they're talking about 5 million Afghan refugees are going to be heading for Europe. 5 million. 1 Thessalonians 5 verse 3 is a verse that came to mind when Biden gave his confident assertion that Taliban could not take over Afghanistan. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them and they shall not escape. Biden's 18-minute speech was an example of nothing but lies and nothing's my fault and blaming others and slandering his allies. So much so that The most stinging indictment of America probably in the last 200 years was given in the British Parliament and the House of Commons by members of the House of Commons to rousing hear-hears and cheers from the people, as was said, about, you realize that America was in Afghanistan as part of a NATO operation, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, because George Bush called on NATO allies. We've been attacked in Takman 1, this Takman War, and so he called for all the NATO allies to help them in the war against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Fair enough. And so, to this day, there are Polish troops there, there are Czech troops there, there are Germans, there are Irish troops, there's troops from all over the EU are inside. Canada's even got force there. And you know, even the Dutch are, and the British and the French and the Germans, they're out there, the Czechs, going out trying to find their civilians and bring them out to evacuate them. But the American military is forbidden to do this. So I never thought you'd see the day where the Dutch army would show more courage than the US military, but that's not fair, because it's actually their politicians who've given that instruction. I'm sure there are many soldiers willing to do it, but not allowed to do it. And this is a disgrace. And the NATO allies said, we weren't even informed. We were not even informed that the Americans were pulling out. They were suddenly presented with this debacle, and they were there to support America. And yet allies like Britain were not even informed ahead of time. All allies claim that. Considering that the Afghan National Army lost over 66,000 men in combat fighting against Taliban, it's neither honest nor fair for Biden to claim that, well, if the Afghans aren't willing to fight to defend their own country, then, you know, there's no point us staying there. Wait a minute, that's not fair. In fact, when the US closed their Bagram air base and withdrew their logistical support, the supply chain, the communications and the air support essential for the Afghan army was terminated. So the entire Afghan National Army was built around American logistics, American air support, American communication system, and they weren't given an alternative structure. The moment the US pulled that out, they no longer had communications. And they were literally, to get hold of other members of the Afghan army, they were needing to use their cell phones. They didn't always know the numbers, because they no longer had a radio communication system, because the entire telecommunication system was just pulled out. And America's left vast quantities of high-tech weapons, which are fallen in the hands of Taliban. Now, this is Bagram Air Base. You just can't even begin to imagine how many billions of dollars this represents. But as the troops were withdrawn first, now, where have you ever come across that you withdraw the troops first and then, oh, civilians, you're on your own. Literally, that's what the State Department said. Now, instead of Bagram Air Base, which was very defendable, it's out in the middle of nowhere, you could easily evacuate. No, people now have to go into Kabul Air Base, which is an airport, which is a single strip in the middle of town, totally surrounded by Taliban. In fact, US State Department even told their people this day, all American citizens, 10 or 15,000, how many there are, nobody knows, in Afghanistan, don't go near the airport, because you know, Taliban are shooting people and all that sort of thing. Who would have expected that? You can't defend this airport in Kabul. It's impossible. Bagram Air Base would have been a perfect place to evacuate if you had to evacuate people. Maybe you've seen the scenes like this horrific thing of people on the runway running along with a plane and actually people grabbing onto the wheels. People falling all the way to the ground from thousands of feet up. They're, when they arrived on the other side, they found dead people in the wheel systems, landing wheels. Never seen scenes like this before. This is the entrance to Bagram Air Base. Extremely strongly built, very defendable, and resistant to terrorism of all sorts. But now you've got this chaos at Kabul Airport. Absolute chaos. If you've seen any video footage of it, you'd just be staggered. To think all the hard work, all the sacrifice of 20 years thrown away. So what did the USA just give to the Taliban? 2,000 armored vehicles, including Humvees and MRAPs. You know what an MRAP is? Mine-resistant armored, what's the P for? Sorry? It's a mine-resistant armored personnel carrier, probably. That's MRAP. You know, we'd call them Biffles, Rattles, and Caspers and so on. 75,000 vehicles in total, including every kind of trucks and pickups and Toyotas. And boy, we would have liked a few of these for Amish. We're kind of short of good vehicles, but Taliban's not short of vehicles anymore. In fact, yay, they have got Land Cruisers, not for Africa, but for Afghanistan. 45 Black Hawk helicopters, some of the most advanced attack helicopters out there. 50 Scout attack helicopters, Scan Eagle military drones, 30 military version Cessnas, 4 C-130s. C-130s, we used to fly the border in the C-130s. 29 Brazilian-made HMS Super Tucano ground attack aircraft. It's not over yet. Over 600,000 small arms, not just M16s and SAWs and the M60s and the whole lot, but sniper systems, 50 caliber weapons, these lovely M203 grenade launchers, the minigun and the Gatling guns, these 20mm Gatling guns with enough ammunition, 61,000 MO3 rounds, that's the handheld grenade launchers, 20,000 grenades, 40 grenade launchers, howitzers, mortars, thousands of rounds, 162,000 pieces of encrypted military communications gear. They can now listen in on American military communications if they come back. 16,000 night vision goggles. I mean, night vision technology in America is so advanced, and it's given a massive advantage. Just like cats have night vision, and a cat's go out hunting at night, and they've got all the advantage. Because if you can see in the dark, you've got tremendous advantage. And the Americans have used the night vision. Now they've given the Taliban it. Newest technology, night vision scopes, thermal scopes. Thermal scopes are so much that, for example, you could be looking through the walls and you can tell who's here and how many people and where they are by just the thermal imaging through walls, that sort of thing. 10,000 2.75-inch air-to-ground rockets. Reconnaissance equipment, and that's infrared systems. Laser aiming units. You can't miss with laser. Explosive ordnance, C4, Semtex. Semtex, the kind of most advanced type of plastic explosive that you could, little bits in a hand carrier could blow up an aircraft, for example. Detonators, shaped chargers, thermites, incendiaries, thousands of bombs. Not finished yet. Administrative encrypted cell phones and laptops, all operational. Pallets with millions of dollars in US currency. You know what a pallet is? I mean, each pallet, if it was a $100 bill, if you just had a $100 bill, one pallet would be $100 million. One pallet. Pallets of millions of dollars in US currency. Millions of rounds of ammunition. At least 20 million rounds of 7.62, which is pretty standard. 9 million of 50 caliber. Large stockpile of plate carriers, body armor, which America is not allowed to export. It's so serious because they've got the most advanced. I've tried to get some of their body armor that they use. And no, you can't get our fourth generation. You can only get the first generation sort of things. We can't export that, but Taliban can have it. Isn't it interesting, by the way, that the Google and Twitter and so on cancelled President Donald Trump's his account, but the Taliban able to have press conferences with Google, Twitter, Facebook and all this, because Taliban don't get their services cancelled. That's only for people who have 32 million followers like President Trump, and who can elect it. Lots of heavy equipment, bulldozers, backhoes, trucks, evacuators. Now, before, they were facing people who even felt the need to use catapults, but now, thank you, they've got some of the most advanced weaponry out there. Reliability and dependability and credibility is at stake here. America's credibility as a reliable ally has suffered yet another devastating blow. And for people who are much younger than me and don't remember all the other ones, I'm going to try and remind you of some of the others, because some people think this is unprecedented. Sadly, this is not unprecedented. In fact, the gifts that were given to the Taliban is dwarfed by what Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave the Soviets in the Second World War to help Stalin survive Operation Barbarossa. Who can trust a government that has such a long trail of treachery, betraying not only the allies, but their own troops at the hands of some of the most merciless Marxists, in this case, jihadists? The British are horrified because they were abandoned, and they're still there trying to get all their citizens out. no thanks to Biden, who's closed Bagram Air Base, which was the main way of getting in and out. The other allies have also been abandoned. Now, if you're hiking through Afghanistan, you'll see every now and then these reminders of the Soviet wreckage. Another empire, as I said, Afghanistan, the graveyard of empires. And Soviet MiGs, still there, not going anywhere. The Afghans, as you can see, were heavily armed with the kind of, when the Russians invaded, they had bolt-action rifles. Now, thanks to the Soviets, they had AKs, PKMs, Dragunovs, RPGs, outstanding, thank you, and RPGs. What would a terrorist group be without RPGs? But now they are able to stand around with not just the Soviet era weapons, but which they've been posing with for quite a while, but now they've got a lot of nice American weapons that have been provided care of Biden. Biden has now become one of the biggest suppliers of arms to terrorists. Now, he's trying to crack down Americans owning firearms and things like that back home, but Taliban, they get millions. Notice at this press conference held by the Taliban, this chap's holding American weaponry, just to let you know, thank you very much, we really appreciate you. That's also American weaponry there to the far right. And so this is in the president's palace in Afghanistan. Last president of Afghanistan just fled. So the Taliban came in with their turbans and held a press conference, thanks to Google and YouTube and so on, not interfering with their Facebook and other platforms for communicating their messages. And so all over Afghanistan, you get cheering from the Taliban supporters. And then a BBC Muslim says, who's representative of the Islamic Sharia Council in Britain, says every Muslim I know is celebrating. Now the Taliban are radical, radical, radical. You know, they flog women, they shoot women in the head at halftime in soccer matches, they force everyone to... You would have thought every woman on the planet would be against the Taliban. At least, anyone who likes freedom would be against the Taliban. Taliban, a lot of Muslims you would think are against the Taliban. A lot. But apparently, according to Muslim from the Islamic Sharia Council in Britain, they cheer it. Now maybe they're not so pro-Taliban, maybe they're just anti-American. 2 Chronicles 19 verse 2. Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord, therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon you. Nobody has ever supplied more weapons, high quality weapons, to a Muslim radical terrorist group than Joe Biden just did in the last month. But this is just one example in a long trail of betrayal. Veteran Angolan freedom fighter Jonas Savimbi, leader of UNITA, in the height of the Cold War, said, "It is better to be America's enemy than America's friend. If you are his enemy, you will probably be bought. But if you're America's friend, you'll certainly be sold." Huh. Now, I was a guest at Jonas Savimbi's headquarters, UNITA headquarters in Jumbo in Free Angola. It's 1986. Jonas Savimbi was by no means anti-American. He was, in fact, he loved American history. He'd regularly be quoting George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, US Constitution. He looked to America as a city on a hill, as an example of faith and freedom that he wanted to emulate in Angola. However, he is referring to the US State Department and its trail of betrayal. Because the US State Department has exported revolution worldwide, and they've been doing it for over 100 years. Jonas Savimbi leaned across the breakfast table and asked, "Do you know why there hasn't been a revolution in America for over 200 years? And then he answered his question saying, "There's no American embassy in America." Well, everyone laughed and some squirmed in their seats. I had some American guests with me at the time. But it's unfortunately true. Just a few highlights. We could keep you here all week if we went through all of them. But do you know that in 1953, a US embassy organized the coup d'etat in Iran? The involvement of American embassies in inciting, fostering, even organizing coup d'etats and revolutions and assassinations around the world are well documented. This isn't conspiracy theory here. Examples include the CIA Operation Ajax, which is declassified, we now know about. They orchestrate the 1953 coup d'etat that overthrew the democratically elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran, who made the cover of Time magazine before. He is considered such an exemplary leader, apparently. Oil companies were heavily involved in financing the street protest and buying of key leaders in Iran, and they persuaded the CIA, under the orders of General Eisenhower, who was then President of America, to seize power and get rid of the democratically elected leader, because he was going to be more, they were going to put a more friendly to oil companies present in Iran. Then there's the coup d'etat in Guatemala for a multinational company. In 1954, the CIA overthrew the president of Guatemala, Jacobo Arbenz, who also was considered exemplary enough person to be put on the cover of Time magazine at that time, to establish a dictatorship which favored the American multinational American United Fruit Company. And again, this is no longer secret, it's been declassified, it's no longer a theory. Then there's the coup in the Dominican Republic. The coup d'etat in Dominican Republic 1962 was organized by the CIA. This is confirmed by the Church Commission. All of these, the Church Commission 1975 uncovered a bundle of other coup d'etats. America was involved for a long time fighting in Vietnam, and many people have made a comparison between the helicopters lifting off people, scrambling to get out of South Vietnam, back in Saigon 1975, with what's going on in Kabul right now. Well, President Ngo Dinh Diem was the president of South Vietnam, and in 1963 his assassination was orchestrated by South Vietnamese generals who requested the CIA's help to bring about the coup d'etat. Now this is an ally. They were assassinating an ally, but yeah, I don't have to go back that far. America and Britain worked on assassinating the government in exile of Poland back in 1943, because they were concerned about the Soviet involvement in the assassination, murder of all the Polish officers and NCOs in the Katyn Forest Massacre. And so the solution was on the 4th of July, assassinating General Sikorsky, his daughter, and his entire cabinet in one go in Gibraltar, 4th of July 1943. So I suppose this is in the same vein. The coup d'etat in Brazil in 1964 included street protests which ousted President João Goulart and replaced him with the Brazilian chief of staff, Juambo Castelo Branco, whose forces were supplied with non-American weapons to make it look like it wasn't an American organized coup. But the National Security Archives, now declassified documents, confirm that President Lyndon Johnson planned this Brazilian coup with his advisors, and this dictatorship lasted 20 years, until 1985. You've heard the term regime change. American governments speak about regime change, and I think this graphic kind of illustrates what you're often talking about. You know, yesterday's freedom fighter becomes tomorrow's oppressor and dictator, and that sort of thing. These and many other regime changes are documented in John Jacob Mutter's book, The CIA Black Ops, Covert Action, Foreign Policy, and Democracy. To use the word democracy in the same term as all this, published in the year 2000. But I can go to a personal friend, much close to home in South Africa. In 1977, South African journalist Ada Parker documented in the Citizen newspaper that the American Embassy Reading Room in Soweto was deliberately subversive, stocking books and pamphlets and magazines, not of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, no, of Mao Zedong and Vladimir Lenin, of Karl Marx, Che Guevara, Fidel Castro, other Marxist revolutionaries. The American Reading Room in Soweto played a major role in galvanizing the revolution that we celebrate now on the 16th of June, each year's Youth Day, which actually involved tearing to pieces and cooking and eating missionaries on the sidewalk in Mtanzania, and burning churches and killing Christians, petrol bombing Christians' homes, targeting Christians, as is documented by the Dorothy Missions book, Soweto But God, which we have republished as a free PDF book, because most people don't know a first-hand eyewitness testimony of what actually happened to Soweto on the 16th of June, 1976. But Ada Parker documented the American Embassy's role in it. Then I can go to people I know personally, like Captain Red McDaniels, legendary figure in America. I met Captain Red McDaniels, or Eugene McDaniels, he's called Red because of his hair color. Very tall man, very big man, friend of General Ben Parton, who's board member of Frontline, very good friend in America. And I've read his book, Scars and Stripes, the true story of one man's courage facing death as a POW in Vietnam. Greg McDaniel's the tall one here. He is flying these intruders, the A6 intruders. He has shot down North Vietnam, and he survived 6 years of torture in captivity in Hanoi. He wrote the book Scars and Stripes. Well, Captain Red McDaniel became involved in the Vietnam War POW MIA, or Missing in Action, campaign to account for the thousands of missing in action Americans abandoned by the government. He knew firsthand about the treachery of the US government, and so he started to expose this. And he pointed us to other books such as Kiss the Boys Goodbye, How the United States Betrayed Its Own POWs in Vietnam. He became the founder and the president of American Defense Institute, the ADI, and he sought to document the trail of betrayal of American prisoners of war or missing in action, not only abandoned in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, but in North Korea and in Russia after the First and Second World Wars. He also introduced me to the book Kiss the Boys Goodbye, and this book documents a whole lot of this. This didn't just start in Vietnam. Woodrow Wilson was abandoning his troops in Russia at the end of the First World War II. There's a deliberate policy to list living prisoners of war as dead. Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso, who had once served the National Security Council staff under President Dwight Eisenhower, testified to the Senate Select Committee on POW-MIA Affairs in 1992 that was deliberate policy to list as dead many of those Americans who were known to have been captured alive by the North Koreans during the Korean conflict. Altogether, 8,177 U.S. servicemen were unaccounted for from the Korean War. That's not counting ones that listed as dead that they knew were alive, but those are the ones who are just literally missing in action. In 1955, President Eisenhower decided the unaccounted for prisoners of war be declared dead, even though they knew they were alive. Colonel Corso testified there were journalists who accepted money from the CIA to report the party line and ignore the reports, persistent reports coming out of American POWs being shipped to the Soviet Union. The fate of our prisoners fell through the cracks. It wasn't an accident, it was policy. This didn't start with Biden. How many people know that Americans were imprisoned in the Soviet Union? By the thousands. Colonel Corso testified that trainloads of American prisoners captured in Korea were shipped to the Soviet Union, and none of those boys ever came back. There's a pattern of denial and deceit. In fact, just to even find these pictures is extremely hard. Senator Robert Smith, Republican, New Hampshire, concluded after this 1992 investigation, Senate investigation to POWs, a large number of American servicemen at the end of the Korean War were left behind, were sent to communist China and to the Soviet Union. Internal documents and statements made at the time also showed that a government believed these men were still alive in captivity, and until only a few months ago, it kept that reality from the American people. It covered up what it knew through a pattern of denial, misleading statements, and in some cases, lies. And in doing so, with regard to the Korean conflict, it broke its commitment to the people who put on the uniform to fight for the freedoms and protection that we and our allies enjoy today. And it's hard to find books on it, but they're starting to come out, American trophies, how US POWs were surrendered to North Korea, China and Russia by Washington's cynical attitude, and American POWs in Korea, 16 personal accounts. I mean, they're coming out. The stories are starting to come out. But in 1991, when the Soviet Union fell, collapsed, broke into 15 republics, a whole lot of files were declassified and opened. And this confirmed US POWs were incarcerated and executed in Russia. General Dmitry Volkomov of the Soviet Red Army testified before the US Senate Select Committee in 1992 that American soldiers who had been prisoners of war of Germany, this would include pilots that had been bombing Germany, shot down, and so on, or maybe they captured Ardennes, offensive in the Battle of the Bulge in 1944, but they were in Eastern Europe and so they were captured by the, they were liberated by the Allies, the Red Army of Russia, who America was pouring hundreds of billions of dollars worth of the best weaponry in the world at that time into, and found themselves in the territory of the USSR at the end of World War II. They were employed in Stalin's Gulag labor camps, and on many cases were summarily executed by the NKVD. American POWs from Korea and Vietnam were also sent to the Soviet Union. The Soviets had also uncovered files of the interrogation of 49 American pilots who had been captured in North Korea and were also held prisoner with 3,000 other Americans near the Russian border. Also, American defectors from the Vietnam War were relocated for propaganda activity with the agreements of the People's Republics of China and of Vietnam, shipped to the Soviet Union. So still the testimony of this Russian general. Many of the 22,000 American prisoners of war in camps liberated by the Soviets during World War II were made slaves in Soviet Gulag concentration camps. He knew of 119 Americans who were believed to be either spies or collaborationists, whatever that means, and they were executed. At least six American prisoners from the Korean War were held at special camps in the Soviet Union, where they were interrogated for 8 years and then they were shot. But there are many records that are still missing. General Volkhomov said his own father had been liquidated under Stalin, and he had not found any record of those circumstances yet. There's still a labyrinth of archaeological excavations to be done through these files. He couldn't rule out the possibility that there had been even more mass transits of American, Korean War, and Vietnamese War servicemen to the Soviet Union, but most of these records were still to be located. I've read this book, I Found God in Soviet Russia by John Noble, with the introduction by Billy Graham, interestingly enough. John Noble wrote the book I Found God in Soviet Russia, printed in 1959, and I Was a Slave in Russia, printed in 1961. He's an American-born citizen, John Noble. He's working in a camera factory in Dresden in 1945. He survived the 15th of February firebombing by the RAF by night and the US Army Air Force by day, 1,000 bomber raids, which incinerated Dresden. And he incredibly survived, and together with his father was arrested by the liberating Soviet Red Army occupation forces, incarcerated in NKVD Special Camp Number 2, located in the former Buchenwald concentration camp site. The Soviet Commissar appropriated, that's another word for stole, the Noble family's Praktika camera factory and their stocks of quality cameras. In 1950, John was sentenced to a further 15 years in the Soviet Gulag. That's been 5 years in the old Buchenwald. Now he is shipped off to Siberia. As John was transferred across the Soviet Union, he saw a message written by an American, Major Frank Roberts, who was recorded as missing in action during World War II, and he saw evidence that he's alive years later. He'd left a message on the walls of one of these rail cars. John Noble ended up in Rokuta Gulag in northernmost Urals, up in Arctic Hell in Siberia. Noble managed to smuggle out a post squad which led to the intervention in 1955, but President Eisenhower brought about his release because publicity by his family and a known name, known place, location, hard to ignore, so Stalin's people, likely Stalin was dead by then, it would have been under Khrushchev. Now, it's interesting because we all do know, or we should know, about the greatest Russian author of the 20th century, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was once a Russian artillery officer in the Second World War, but he was sentenced to 8 years hard labor as a slave in a gulag because he had written an insulting term in private correspondence. He referred to the illustrious leader as the mustached one, and that was enough for him to get thrown into the gulag for 8 years, even though he is a war hero, but nevertheless. Well, Alexander Solzhenitsyn introduced us to what the Arctic hell of the gulag was in his book, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. And he wrote the book, The Gulag Archipelago, and a whole lot of other great books, like The Cancer Ward and so on. These are now required reading in Russia, school textbooks. He gave us the term gulag to explain the 1,200 Soviet concentration camps that have sucked up 50 million lives in the 20th century. Then the Pentagon finally released a gulag study which admitted their policy of suppressing prisoner of war reports. The Gulag study by the Pentagon concluded that American servicemen were imprisoned in a former Soviet Union after denying it for decades. And after ignoring volumes of documentation for more than 50 years, half a century, the Pentagon finally admitted it had been a matter of policy to suppress reports of American prisoners of war and MIAs incarcerated in the Soviet Union and Red China. And this is just one of the maps. It comes from one of her books, which is a guided tour of the concentration camps of the Soviet Union. And most of these areas up here in Siberia are just prison camp areas. So when I call it the Gulag Archipelago, you get small camps, you get big areas and camps and massive areas, salt mines and all the rest of it. Colonel Simpson, US Air Force, revealed that while serving as an Air Force attaché at the US Embassy in Hong Kong, he learned from Russian defectors that had personally witnessed hundreds of American servicemen from the Korean War being transferred by the Chinese to the Soviets at the Chinese-Russian border at Manchulai. And Simpson had filed a high-priority report to his seniors, and he knew it had reached the hands of the Secretary of State, which would be equivalent to our Minister of Foreign Affairs, John Foster Dulles. But these reports were buried by Eisenhower. During the administration of President Ronald Reagan, Simpson's original report was retrieved from the dark holes that it had been tossed into decades before. See, Ronald Reagan had an interest in the prisoners of war, MIAs, and he authorized massive investigations, and this started to make the archaeological excavations that revealed a lot of these things. Colonel Simpson said he had been told by a senior member of Eisenhower's administration that President Eisenhower concluded nothing could be done to retrieve the men from the captivity, so the reports were buried. They were betrayed by their own governments. Reports have also been unearthed of American soldiers who'd been fighting against the Bolsheviks at the conclusion of World War I. There was a secret US military expedition to Archangel, and thousands of these men had fallen to the hands of the Red Army. The government of President Woodrow Wilson, who had sent them there, suppressed these facts, kept the plight of these thousands of American soldiers from the electorate. First time I heard of it was from Captain Red McDaniels, and I read about it and kissed the boys goodbye. But now these facts have come out. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. What a man sows, that shall he reap. Commander Jeremiah Denton was his a commander when he was captured, became an admiral later, became a senator. He was a good friend. He sent us 100 copies of his book when hell was in session. I read it before my first prison experience, and I must say, the insights in there helped me psychologically, spiritually, practically to not only survive but thrive in imprisonment and in solitary confinement and interrogation. Brilliant, brilliant man. When he retired from politics, his secretary, Sharon Golden, came down and joined our mission and later went on to work for Gospel Defense League under Mrs. Scarborough. So we've got quite a connection with Admiral Jeremiah Denton. Well, picture on the left shows him before flying into Vietnam. Senator Denton, he had fought in the Korean War. He was flying off an aircraft carrier in the Vietnam War. He wrote the book When Hell Was in Session. In 1965, Commander Denton, piloting an A-6 intruder jet, was shot down over North Vietnam and captured. And he is imprisoned in what they called the Hanoi Hilton. This is a French prison built during the French occupation of, remember, Vietnam used to be part of French Indochina. And the communists turned into a real hellhole, and the inmates called it the Hanoi Hilton. He is there for almost 8 years. He is there the longest, and he is tortured the worst because he is the senior officer of the American prisons. A color picture of the same facility. Denton was held prisoner for almost 8 years, severely tortured as a POW. During a televised press conference in 1966, he used the opportunity to send out a distress message by repeatedly blinking his eyes in Morse code, spelling out T-O-R-T-U-R-E, torture. And of course, naval people back home immediately recognized the Morse code in his blinking. He was known for resistance. For example, when they did a propaganda stunt of for an hour and a half, made the prisoners of war walk through Hanoi, where the people were throwing rocks at them and beating them and kicking them and spitting on them and so on. And they were ordered to lower their heads. As the crowd got thick and louder, a guard shouted, "Bow your heads," and the word shot through me like a streak of lightning. I shouted, "You Americans, keep your heads up." And it's that kind of mentality of resistance that made him a target for special treatment. When questioned on TV about his support for the US war effort in Vietnam, he replied, "Whatever the position of my government is, I support it fully. Whatever the position of a government is, I believe in it. Yes, sir, I'm a member of that government, And it's my job to support it, and I will as long as I live. And you can actually see that footage. It's still out there. It's up on YouTube, quite staggering. And all the time he's saying this, he's blinking in Morse code, communicating what he wanted to the world, tortured. He is severely tortured for that resistance. And when it came out that people in the West had recognized his Morse code blinking out torture, he was given even further torment and taken away to another place called Alcatraz. Well, they called it Alcatraz, where he and 10 others, 11 of the most resistant Americans, were separate from the rest, and they were just given the worst treatment possible. As a senior member of the U.S. prisons of war, he is targeted for special treatment, in other words, by his tormentors. Now, he fought in the Second World War, he fought in Korea, fought in Vietnam. Prison of war for almost 8 years. Phenomenal amount of awards for valor. And then he became a rear admiral and a senator. And a very good friend and ally of Ronald Reagan. And he and Ronald Reagan worked a lot on fighting to defeat communism. Denton was known as the Hawk of Hawks, meaning he's not a dove. He believed in strongest military action against the communists, which makes sense, given his background. Senator Jeremiah Denton then set up and chaired the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Security and Terrorism, which exposed Soviet KGB communist control of the African National Congress terrorist group in South Africa. We've got the book here, the Denton Report, and one of the connections with ourselves is Bartholomew Moro Shlapani. I'm sorry, it's the only picture I could find of the man. It's very hard to get a picture of him. Bartholomew Shlapani was a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of South Africa and of the ANC. And he testified before the Denton Commission that the KGB controlled the Southern Communist Party and the Southern Communist Party controlled the ANC. And nothing could be done in the ANC that wasn't controlled by the KGB and the Soviet Union. And he and his wife were murdered just months after he had testified. 9 months after he had testified before the Denton Commission in Washington, D.C., he was murdered by AK-47 wielding assassins in his home in Soweto. And his daughter, Pansy, was crippled, paralyzed from it. Now, I've pushed Pansy in her wheelchair to meetings, and when she is 18 years old, we went up to Frankfurt to testify against those who were seeking to bring sanctions on South Africa and so on at the Kirchentag. And as I was wheeling Pansy Shlapani, 18-year-old girl, paralyzed from the neck down from an AK-40 bullet, the same people who'd murdered her parents that night crippled her. And as she's coming to testify what her father stood for and what he had exposed, I saw communists shaking boxes of matches in Pansy's face and saying, "We're going to necklace you. You get back south and we'll burn you alive." Can you imagine the kind of people who do that to someone crippled who's just trying to tell the truth about what happened to her parents and what her father stood for? Well, Senator Jeremiah Denton exposed the communist control of the ANC. Well, if you want to know about Missing in Action Vietnam, one film that will enable you to understand it very well is the Noe Hilton. This depicts some of the tortures and abuse which the U.S. prisoners of war and MIAs suffered in communist Vietnam. Although they chose not to use the names of the actual people who were there, they used fictionalized characters, but real events, I think, so the telescope, many characters and so on, but you can tell who they're meaning to be, Senator Denton, who's been, and so on. But nevertheless, the Hanoi Hilton is hated by the media, and they try to boycott this totally because it's just so effective in showing not only the torments and poured on them by the communists and the Christian strength and prayer and how they communicated, but it exposes Jane Fonda, who came in, this famous Jane Fonda from America, who came in as part of a propaganda effort for the communists and tried to bully the men and complained when the men were resisting, when the men were slipping her notes about the torture having or communicating. She passed it on to the camp commander and said, "You've got to deal with these people." And they broke arms of people who had tried to, who had succeeded in giving notes to her and things like this. And she insisted on getting a picture behind an anti-aircraft gun and said, "I wish I had one of these bastards in my sight right now and blow them out of the sky." Now, this, obviously she's speaking about Americans who were coming over, and imagine, they call her Hanoi Jane. This Jane Fonda, typical of Hollywood, hated the American military, loved the communists who were torturing them. And even when the people testified, and it comes out in the Noy Hilton film very well, which is why Hollywood boycotted the film and cinemas didn't want to show it, about the only way you can get it is through a circuitous route on the internet and so on. But anyway, this Hanoi Hilton needs a lot of praise for that. Of course, more of us have probably seen Missing in Action series of Chuck Norris or Uncommon Valor. These films depict some of the tortures and abuse which the American prisoners of war and MIAs suffered in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. But the reality, Captain Red McDaniels and Jeremiah Denton revealed, was far, far, far worse. None of these films come close to doing justice to what was happening, what the people endured in those prisons. Now, through America's ambassador to Romania, my first week in America back in 1988, very eventful, I met the American ambassador to Romania, and he introduced me to Michelle Sturdza, former Romanian foreign minister who authored Betrayed by Rulers, and I got a copy of this book from him at the religious broadcasting convention that I was at in Washington, D.C. Prince Sturdza documents the pattern of treachery that cannot be explained by folly, stupidity, or accident, quoting from him. He indicts American presidents Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson as treacherous, not only to the Allies, but to Western Christian civilization. And he wrote the book, The Suicide of Europe, as well. FDR and Winston Churchill's betrayal of millions of Christians in Eastern Europe, over 150 million actually, to Stalin's brutal Soviet Union at the Tehran Conference, at the Yalta Conference, at Potsdam, were some of the greatest blows against freedom in the history of the world. This written by Romania's foreign minister. Psalm 140 verse 2 says, who plan evil things in their hearts, they continually gather together for war. And Prince Sturdza and others are convinced that these are three of the most evil men of the 20th century, who between them have more blood on their hands than any other combination you can imagine. Nikolai Tolstoy, a relation of the famous Leo Tolstoy, who wrote War and Peace and so on, he wrote the first expose on the victims of Yalta, the secret betrayal of the Allies, or it should be the secret betrayal by the Allies, 1944 to 1947. He's talking about the betrayal of the whole of Eastern and Central Europe. How many of you know of the Russian Liberation Army? The Russian Liberation Army were volunteers, hundreds of thousands of them in the Second World War, who fought alongside the Germans, Cossacks and others, to fight against the Reds, against the people who had commit the Holodomor that killed 11 million people by starvation in Ukraine, all the different atrocities. So the Cossacks have got a great military history, mostly Ukrainian, a whole warrior class, all the men would be soldiers, the cavalry, great horsemen, great swordsmen. And so the Cossacks joyfully joined up with the German allies, the Central Powers, in fighting against the Bolsheviks, the Reds. And these are some of the Cossacks involved in Operation Barbarossa. Fought very bravely, very well. Orthodox Christians, of course. Well, Nikolai Tolstoy documents the first-hand revelation of one of the most shameful episodes of the Second World War, handing over to the Soviets of 2 million Russians by the West. And Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote the endorsement for this book, which, by the way, got banned in Britain. And when Leo Tolstoy went to court about this, the British courts just threw it out. They could not handle at that stage expose of one of the most shameful episodes in recent British history. I read this book as a 15-year-old, written by Nicholas Bethel, the first opening of my mind to this side of history. Up till age 15, I thought the Allies were the good guys. But this book started to make me think twice. And this depicts the horrific scene as a result of the Yalta Agreement, the betrayal of millions of Russians, Ukrainians, East Europeans, and others into the hands of the Soviets. British and American forces using force, bayonets, rifle butts, beating, stabbing, shooting even, forcing Russians, not just the soldiers, but their wives and their children and their babies. To explain to you how bad it was, this is in the Alps of Austria. They forced them across the border into the hands of the Soviets, mothers throwing their babies in the icy waters. Can you imagine that a scene like that could happen? That's how bad it was. And suicides, not by the hundreds, by the thousands of people before being handed over to service. And the British and American forces, and this was kept secret for 30 years. For 30 years, it was silence in the West, banned and so on, even though there were people like Alexander Solzhenitsyn and Leo Tolstoy and others who let it be known. But this book, The Last Secret, in fact, that's the cover of the book I read. It's not The Last Secret, there's a lot of others too. Nigel Hawthorne brought up The Iron Cage, speaking about the British prisoners of war abandoned in Soviet hands that in the 1970s were still alive in the Soviet Union. The Iron Cage. Well, we know a lot of documentation that's gone into this. And now more's coming out about the secret betrayal of Britain's wartime allies, such as the Christians in Yugoslavia, who were betrayed as the British SOE operations worked to aid the communist of Tito against the Christians of Prince Michael. And time and again, you can just see how this was the way it worked. Your staunchest ally can be your deadliest foe, fatal ally. Betrayed ally, China in the Great War. Nationalist China was the ally of the West during the war and betrayed in the hands of communists immediately afterwards. Ally betrayed. You know that today, the real Republic of China is Taiwan. That's where the nationalists had to flee to as they were betrayed by their wartime allies into the hands of the communists at the end of the Second World War. I've read the book Ally Betrayed, it's in our library, Republic of China by David Rowe. Now, Professor Rowe was Professor of Political Science at Yale University and a specialist in Far East history, politics and international relations, probably the greatest expert in East Asian relations. As a leading American authority on China, he documents how the US government betrayed free China, nationalist China, in the hands of Mao's brutal communist, Red China. The betrayal of the Republic of China at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party continues to have disastrous implications this day, including not least the COVID-19, the lockdowns, and all the other things that have come, not to mention the savage killing of our rhinos for their horns and our elephants for ivory, and the stripping of whole forests in Africa for China. The brutality of this communist regime in China is devastating us right down to Cape Town. I mean, the Chinese influence is all the way here. So the blood on the hands of these people who betrayed them. Now, Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, in politics, nothing happens by accident. If it happens, you can bet it was planned this way. Now, that quote coming from the man who sat next to the biggest, most brutal, savage, mass-murdering dictator of the 20th century, Joseph Stalin, who gave him everything Stalin could have ever asked for, and then gave him more. Well, the East Europeans have written books like Sell Out to Stalin. One of the swear words in Eastern Europe is Yalta, which is where you just say the word Yalta and people in Eastern Europe, they have a physical reaction. Because they were betrayed by their allies. Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon you. And to understand the gravity of what you're talking about, one just needs to read something like the 900-page doorstopper Black Book of Communism. This is not written by anti-communists. These are written by communists. Stefan Cortes, the editor, he was the editor of Communisme magazine in France. These are all Communist Party members who, when the Soviet Union collapsed and the files were opened, they suddenly were able to see, and from their own files, their own records, documented 100 million people murdered under Soviet Union between 1917 and 1991. And just from their own archives and documentations. And this is what FDR called Uncle Joe, our ally. Then there's Republic of Korea. I've got the other book on our shelf, Ally Betrayed the Republic of Korea. It's another story. Another one, we've got Ally Betrayed Nicaragua, with a foreword by US Ambassador Beryl Smith and postscript by US Ambassador Turner Shelton. These are not some conspiracy theorists. These are people who are the actual ambassadors there, people who are first-hand eyewitnesses. It quotes Lieutenant General Gordon Sumner. Nicaragua was subverted from within and attacked from without. The record is quite clear in this regard. The role of the Carter administration in this shabby affair, the Carter strategy of polarization using human rights as the operative principle has succeeded in destroying the strategic position of the United States and the Caribbean Basin, as well as of the Western Hemisphere. And he indicts Jimmy Carter. Nicaragua's strategic country in Central America was lost as a member of the free world community of nations. Its democratically elected government was overthrown by Marxist campaign of sabotage and terrorism, which was supported by the deliberate political destabilization of the freely elected government by the U.S. administration headed by President Carter in 1979. Same year they were betraying Iran and South Africa, they were betraying Nicaragua, Rhodesia, I should say. The politics of deceit adopted by the U.S. Department of State and the massive Cuban support given to the Sandinista communist terrorists were largely ignored by the U.S. media. In fact, they produced a film to glamorize this called Under Fire, which glamorizes the media's role in bringing about this revolution of communist victory. But of course, you know, Sandinista communists are the good guys, somehow. The triumph of the Sandinista terrorist movement encouraged Fidel Castro and the Soviets to assist further revolutionary upheavals in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. How many millions died as a result of this policy? And if you really want your head turned, you just need to read a book like Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution by Professor Anthony Sutton. A research fellow of the Hoover Institute, Stanford University, wrote Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, all these books on our library downstairs. It documents the shocking links between the New York bankers, I call them banksters, you know, gangster, and many revolutionaries like Trotsky, who was bankrolled by the millions in what became the Soviet Union. And then he wrote the book, The Best Enemy Money Can Buy, and Energy that Created Crisis, and The War on Gold, which is basically the war in South Africa, and America's Secret Establishment. So, fascinating, Wall Street and FDR. This man is just a bundle of interesting info, but it's like he's banned. Try to find something on him out there. Fortunately, that's why you need hard copy books, because the internet, they can scrub it. Very hard to find things on him on the internet. But Professor Sutton wrote the book, The Best Enemy Money Can Buy, documenting how the Soviet Union and Red China were built up with Western technology and aid by US government policy. And then there's the country I was raised in, Rhodesia. Prime Minister Ian Smith of Rhodesia declared, "We were never beaten by our enemies, we were betrayed by our friends." The title of his biography is The Great Betrayal. Now remember, this is a man who fought 6 years in the Second World War in the Royal Rhodesian Air Force, shot down twice, including behind enemy lines in Italy, spent 5 months behind enemy lines, operating, climbed over the Alps, barefoot, mind you. The betrayal of Rhodesia to Mugabe's Marxist Zimbabwe continues to have disastrous repercussions to this day. He thought Britain and America were his allies. I mean, he fought alongside in the Second World War, only to be stabbed in the back. Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them, which is what we're trying to do tonight. The doorstop of all doorstoppers to expose all this is Freedom of Trade by Herbert Hoover. President Herbert Hoover. It's not a conspiracy theorist. This is America's 31st president, a Nobel Award winner. He spent 20 years researching and writing a monumental documentation of U.S. Department of State treachery. The title of his book, Freedom Betrayed, Herbert Hoover's Secret History of the Second World War and its Aftermath. Just before this book was to be published, he died abruptly, suddenly, no explanation. And his book was banned for 50 years, shelved. A President of the United States book, banned for 50 years. And when it came out recently, I managed to get a copy of this. Staggering. President Herbert Hoover documents the treacherous policies of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration in fomenting the war, in putting up Poland to resist handing back German territory in Danzig and so on, and putting up Britain to put up the war guarantee, putting up France to get involved in this, and promising all the aid, basically orchestrating the war from all sides, behind the scenes. Many people thought America came in reluctantly a few years later. No, they initiated from the beginning, Herbert Hoover proves. In betraying the Christians of Central and Eastern Europe into the hands of Stalin's brutal Soviet Union. For with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. There's a lot of consequences that come. Just read Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, Jeremiah 18. There's some uncomfortable truths in Freedom Betrayed that expose the real agenda of FDR. This man was a Marxist. And this is Molotov, by the way. He's the Foreign Affairs Minister of Stalin. And Ronald. Stalin and FDR were right in bed together. Hoover's Freedom Betrayed is a 900-page encyclopedia of uncomfortable truths that seriously challenged the traditional views of American President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Herbert Hoover documents that FDR's foreign policies were not merely disastrous, not merely catastrophic, but they were treacherous, as in treason. His shocking exposés proved to become one of the most important historic documents of the 20th century, a searing indictment of FDR and the politicians around whom he lied prodigiously to conceal a nefarious evil agenda. And this basically forces almost all films, books, and documentaries of the Second World War to be rewritten, because the role of FDR, the treachery, I mean, this man is not a hero, this man is as evil as it comes. The words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but war was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet they were drawn swords. And that brings one to the betrayal of Iran. There was a time when Iran was the best friend and ally and the most stabilizing influence in the Middle East. The Shah story, written by Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, who is the last Shah of Iran, documents the treacherous role which the U.S. State Department under President Jimmy Carter, which led to the Islamic Revolution of 11 February 1979. It ended the 2,000-year of continuous Persian monarchy since the founding of the Persian Empire by Cyrus the Great, who's mentioned in the Bible. There was a time that the Persian Empire stretched a long way, from the Arabian Sea to the Mediterranean. During the last Shah of Iran, his 38-year reign, Iran went through a series of economic, social, and political reforms which transformed that country into a global power with a national income rising 423 times over. It's just the most staggering economic growth imaginable. By 1977, Iran's military had become the world's fifth strongest armed forces. Iran's economic growth rate exceeded that of the United States, Great Britain, and France combined. And it was a major stabilizing force considered America's most important ally in the Middle East. But Jimmy Carter bullied, cajoled, pressured, and everything for him to allow this Ayatollah Khomeini to return to Iran. And when it did, it just destroyed the credibility of, just like the release of Mandela was like one of the key elements that media worked this up. And when the Ayatollah returned and when the Shah had to give in to Jimmy Carter's pressures, it just imploded, led to a series of catastrophic events and brought down this long-standing Western stabilizing influence ally in the Middle East and put in the Ayatollahs. And we haven't seen the end of this debacle 41 years later, Jimmy Carter's foreign policy legacy. The destabilizing and the betrayal of Iran in 1979 continues to have disastrous repercussions to this day. And 40 years from now, people will be talking about what's happened in 2021 for the betrayal of Afghanistan. No win wars. On my first visit to America in January 1988, I heard Colonel Oliver North describe how he had been ordered time and again to take his Marines to take a position in Vietnam, only to be ordered to withdraw it later. To then be told to retake the same position, which then was far better defended, they would succeed the second time at greater loss of life, only to be ordered to withdraw from that position, and then a third time to be instructed to retake the same position, which now was further entrenched, now with concrete barbed wire and with more devastating weaponry. At greater loss of life, the US Marines would succeed in taking that position a third time, only to be ordered to withdraw from that position again. This has been the story of Vietnam and Korea and Afghanistan over and over. I remember the horror and shock I left. I really felt as I listened to his first-hand testimony of the criminal short-sightedness, of the malicious treachery of US government officials towards their own armed forces. People who don't even respect and care for the lives of their own armed forces, what do you think they think about their allies? But our Creator and our eternal Judge will bring injustice to light. Woe to her who is rebellious and polluted, to the oppressing city. She has not obeyed his voice. She has not received correction. She has not trusted the Lord. She has not drawn near to her Lord. Her princes in the midst are roaring lions. Her judges are like evening wolves that leave not a bone till morning. Her prophets are insolent, treacherous people. Her priests have polluted the sanctuary. They have done violence to the Lord. The Lord is righteous in the midst. He will do no unrighteousness. Every morning he brings us justice to light. He never fails. But the unjust knows no shame. Some time ago we showed the film Roe v. Wade, which documented very factually the treachery, not just of the media, but of the US Supreme Court in legalizing abortion in America. You think passages like this from the prophets, that a lot of people have got a lot to answer for. In January 1988, my first visit to America, I met with a political leader who commented, you must understand there's some method to this madness. For every ally we betray, we get a whole lot of new restaurants to choose from here in Washington, D.C. Standing on a street corner, we looked out, we saw a Chinese restaurant, Vietnamese restaurant, and over there's a Hungarian restaurant. And a few blocks away is a Mongolian restaurant, he said. I looked at him to see if this is some kind of sick joke, but he gave me a bitterly frustrated look. He grieved that this was a truth spoken in jest. But I say to you that for every idle word men speak, they will have to give an account of it in the day of judgment. For by your words you'll be justified, and by your words you'll be condemned. What will people like Biden, or the people who put him there, or pull the strings behind him, or FDR, or Woodrow Wilson, or Winston Churchill, or Stalin, have to say to God in the day of judgment? There has been a policy of appeasing enemies and betraying friends going back for more than 100 years in American policy, from Woodrow Wilson, with some good exceptions like Ronald Reagan. He put freedom on the offensive. But with few exceptions, there's been a trail of treachery. While they promised them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. And you can see that. If you make a mistake once, we're all human, everyone makes a mistake. If you make the same mistake twice, you're stupid. If you make the same mistake 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 times, you've got a hidden agenda. Nobody can be that stupid. No wonder our friend Jonas Avimbi declared many years ago in Angola, it's better to be America's enemy than America's friend. If you're her enemy, you'll probably be bought, but if you're America's friend, you'll certainly be sold. So I sought for a man among them who would stand before me in the gap and build up the wall and intercede on behalf of land that I should not have to destroy it. The treachery of the globalists needs to be exposed and needs to be opposed. Light is more powerful than darkness. Truth is more powerful than error. Many American people are good people, but they need to be aware of the deep state, the swamp, which has the blood of many millions of innocents on their hands. And those who treacherously betray their friends and allies and others who trust them, who could even abandon their own military in Marxist hellholes and to lie to cover it up, cannot be trusted. And so what's going on in Afghanistan now should remind us of the persecuted church and of the hundreds of millions of Christian victims of these treacherous globalists who have been doing this now for the best part of a century. Who will rise up for me against the evildoers? Who will stand up for me against the workers of iniquity? I know it's been a very long presentation, but all these things just came so obviously to mind as I've seen the results of the last few weeks. I've had some radio programs on this, and I haven't exhausted it, but I knew we had to put together a comprehensive, concise expose, because people need to know, this isn't just because Biden's senile. This is people behind him. This isn't just Biden. He's the front man. There is a deep state swamp of globalists out there, a synagogue of Satan, an alliance of banksters and powers, Illuminati, Council of Foreign Relations, Freemasons, there's a whole range of groups interlocking, the Bilderbergers and others, but they have got the blood of the Christian civilization of the 20th century hands. In 1910, the world was run overwhelmingly by Christians. Today, there's barely one Christian country left in the planet. Mm-hmm. And this has not been accidental. This is a deliberate anti-Christian agenda, and we need to know where it is. And while people need to have the outrage about what's going on in Afghanistan, they need to recognize this is part of a pattern. This is not an isolated incident. This didn't just start with Biden. Evil and foolish though he is, but he's just the puppet. There's a whole bunch of others behind. So, questions, comments? I might add, I've got notes of what I've given at the table that you can take away. Yes?
I just wanted to ask, do you think China is behind this in Afghanistan?
Not necessarily. I think China's a major player in the whole field, and they're going to step in and they're going to benefit. And I think there were a source of arms, although they couldn't possibly be as generous as Biden's been equipping the Taliban, but Red China has been a major supplier of arms to, for example, Sudan. A lot of the weapons we've been facing and had thrown at us when we've been bombed in Sudan has come from China. China's behind a lot of things, like the rhino poaching, ivory poaching, and all of that stripping of our forests in Africa, even trawling our fish off our coast. And so China's involved in a lot of this, but they're globalists even above them. And China's a major player, but they're not the ones making the decisions. I believe they're just one of the major tools that's being used by the wicked. Other comments or questions? Yes.
Surely this is a chess move, you know, to leave these weapons. They're not that secret that they're going to leave these weapons there. This must be a plan. They obviously want these weapons used for something.
Yes. I mean, it's just beyond staggering. Do you know when the CIA abandoned Saigon in 1975, they left all the files untouched of every South Vietnamese who'd ever helped the Americans. Translators, helping interrogation, people who'd been informers and so on. They left it, they didn't bother to shred, incinerate, destroy or take with them those files. They left it all there so that they were able to track down every one of these. And that sort of, why would you do that? That is beyond treacherous. But when you see this pattern, as I said, you can understand a mistake, even though some mistakes like that is unforgivable. But when you see a pattern, you've just got to recognize there is an agenda here. And while there's good people in the systems who don't realize where they fit in the big scheme of things, one has to see, you have to step back, see the pattern. And then you sort of see there is a globalist antichrist agenda. And that's why when you look at Revelation 13, the beast moves for one world government and one world economic system, a one world interfaith religious system. And he wants people to get a mark without which you won't be able to buy or sell. I mean, this should ring bells. One should say, people have got a globalist agenda. It fits into what we warned about in the Bible, and it's wicked. At its core, many of these people involved in these high areas of power are Satanists. Not just occult, but Satanists. And the Jeffrey Epsteins of this world, evidence is they weren't just pedophiles, they weren't just abusers and all of the rest. They were involved in satanic, occultic, literally worshipping Satan. And I've heard that from people on the ground as well, that, you know, these people are actual Satan worshippers. It's a very evil group that you're dealing with. And people who think that this is just a matter of policies between one party and another or personalities are missing the big picture. Other comments, observations?
Yeah, a few comments. I think the one thing I want to ask is, why sever your international relationships like that? Why not warn your allies that you're withdrawing when you do that? I mean, that just doesn't make any practical sense.
No, it doesn't make practical sense. I mean, if you're a patriotic American, even if you've got different policies, it wouldn't make sense. If you want to have good friends, good allies, why would you do that? But if your goal is to break up Christian civilization, if your goal is to break down the United States, NATO, Western civilization, then these are it's like, why would you betray millions of Christians at the end of the Second World War in the hands of the Soviet Union in a war that's meant to be for freedom? People in Eastern Europe said none of us got freedom, indeed. And so why would you do some of the most vindictive things that have been done all the way along? And you could, why would they have to destroy Rhodesia, which had the lowest unemployment, the lowest crime rate, the highest educational standards in the whole continent, the highest literacy rate in the continent? And why they have to, because it was so peaceful, that's why they had to destroy it. And you might say, but what replaced was worse? But that's the aim. They do want chaos. And remember, if you are a social Darwinist, once upon a time there was nothing, then there was something, that something exploded for no reason, and it became self-replicating dinosaurs and so on. Now, if you believe in the Big Bang theory, and you, as a social Darwinist, would believe the more we can blow things up and the more we can burn things down, out of ashes will arise utopia. Because, I mean, everything in the world came about through a Big Bang, so let's see if we can blow enough things up and then we'll create workers' paradise. And Vladimir Lenin said, never underestimate the power of constructive chaos. So constructive chaos to the communists, you need chaos and violence. In fact, what did Karl Marx say? Violence is the midwife to a socialist state. You need chaos. And that's why they love this coronavirus, because it gives them an excuse to take more power, and take way more freedoms and charge you more money for things. And they end up with more power. People end up with less freedoms. Communist agenda advances. So whether they use war, violence, treachery, man-made viruses from Wuhan, whatever, it's all advancing their agenda. And we've got to see it, and we've got to resist, and we've got to expose it. And truth is more powerful than lies. Light is more powerful than darkness.
Yeah. Sorry, just second comment. I've seen a video of some Afghan infantry being forced to give up their weapons. So just the thought that the order came from commanding officers, it wasn't what you were presenting away. It's not a lack of courage, it's not a lack of commitment from soldiers. They've lost a lot of soldiers in the war the last 20 years. So how does that work? Why would the Afghani local army, I don't want to say surrender, but at least give up?
Okay, so I think the army was fine when they knew we've got America behind us and Britain and mm-hmm. all the other places providing different support structures. They're in the field, they're doing the fighting. I don't think any NATO troops are doing combat duties in the last years. They were there for support. Logistical support, technological support, supply chain, and air power as needed. So when, without even discussion, without even a warning, your biggest ally suddenly leaves, the morale loss is shattering. But it goes along with suddenly losing your communications network and your air support and suddenly your supplies. You can imagine, it doesn't take long to be in the field, you're running out of ammo, food, medicines, petroleum, whatever it is, and there's no air support. You can imagine how some may, in this situation, just feel overwhelmed, and it's a shattering of morale. And it's that kind of treachery that just leaves people devastated. Sure. So I would imagine that if they had kept just a nominal force there in the air base, there's just one base, Bagram Air Base, if they kept that open and maintained basic operations, not one American soldier had died in the last 18 months. Obviously, they didn't need to be involved in combat. The Afghan army were doing the fighting. The moment they just pulled out, in the way they pulled out, there wasn't a proper handover. I think it was the shock factor that probably led to this. And then the feeling of we're overwhelmed, there's nothing we can do. Personally, I don't think they should have surrendered. I don't think they should have stopped. They should have done whatever they could to resist, because I don't think their lives are going to be worth anything. If we've learned anything over the years, like the Cossacks at the end of the Second World War, the British officers come up to him very politely and ask him to move to this area, and then, could you hand over your weapons? We're going to supply you with Western weapons so that you can, the ammunition is compatible with ours. They lie. They know what's going to happen. And these people just went along with it because they trusted the allies. When the allies betrayed them, many of them just responded with suicide. It's hard to imagine that situation. As far as I'm concerned, you never give up. You always fight and resist. But if people have an illusion, if you believe in the goodness of man, you don't understand the depravity of man, you don't understand how treacherous the enemy can be, you might be tempted to give up. But as Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, we should never have gone along with it. We were always more than the communists. Said if every one of us had resisted, they wouldn't have been able to kill us all. But the amount of us who died because we tried to go along with it, because we basically were nice people. And so Russians died by the tens of millions because the communists exploited our basic Christian ethos, where we also believed people and didn't think people would lie to your face. Yes?
What do you think is going to happen next with the alternates?
It's going to get worse and worse unless there's some kind of decision. Now, for example, as it's been pointed out, this would have been impossible under Trump. In fact, Trump ran on a ticket of getting out of Afghanistan and no-win wars and things like this. But he was persuaded by the military early on that you must keep a small force there, but he had his forces not involved in any combat in the whole time he was there, and he downsized in Afghanistan. But he met with the Taliban and said to him, if this, that, or the other happens, we'll be back in here and we're going to bomb the hell out of you and all the rest of it. And he warned him. And that's why no Americans were being touched, because he had laid down it all. But now Biden signals a whole new American lack of will. So when you have a strong president or leadership or strong foreign policy, it encourages respect. So I can say this. Under Jimmy Carter, America was despised. Under Ronald Reagan, America was respected. Under Clinton, America was hated. And so on. some respect for America came back under George W. Bush Jr. when you saw America's taking strength, but they just carried it on too long. They didn't know when to stop. And they came resent. Under Obama, I think people, especially in the Middle East, came to hate him. And because of what he did. And so you have this kind of up and down. And at the end, which ally will ever trust America again? It's going to take an enormous amount to rebuild trust. Because the betrayal all the way along. There was a time that I thought America is the leader of the free world. Well, it's not the leader of the free world these days. Right now, Putin and Russia look far more leaders of the free world than Biden and America. It's shocking. Right now, they look like the leader of the perverts. Or at least that's Biden's policy.
My question is, what does the average left American think about what America did to Afghanistan?
Fascinatingly, they're horrified. Even the ones who've been lying and covering for Biden all the way through the elections, CNN and so on, they are all, how can he say that? And when the press secretary says things like, there's no Americans abandoned or stranded, and even CNN, who I've always called the Clinton News Network or the Communist News Network, even they are aghast. And it looks like Biden's cheerleaders and marketing strategists are now turning against him. I think what's happening here is Biden's been set up to be kicked out one way or the other. He might be, and then Kamala Harris gets it, who might be worse. And then Nancy Pelosi might become the vice president, because if you've kicked out the vice president for one reason or another, or he dies or gets declared senile, whatever they do, Kamala Harris is vice president, immediately is president, and then she can choose the vice president who's normally taken from who's the Speaker of the House. And so, for example, when they first got rid of Nixon's vice president, then they got rid of Richard Nixon back in the 70s, and then what happened was Gerald Ford, who nobody had voted for in the sense of president or vice president, he suddenly became president, and he gets John D. Rockefeller as the vice president. Uh-huh. Neither of them have ever been elected, and it was just like, you know, you managed to remove the people who are elected, and before you know it, you've got a presto, Council on Foreign Relations, banksters have got their own government, and John D. Rockefeller, who happened to be one of the richest people in the world, in the Senate hearings for his confirmation as vice president, they dug around and somebody found out he had never paid income tax, ever. And he has, oh, yes, well, you know, I've got people to deal with that something for me, I don't know. How much you're worth, have no idea. And he still became vice president. Anyway, so I think you could see something like that, where suddenly you could have a whole new, and you might even come in and might disappear and it might be somebody else. But what they've done is they knew Biden wasn't up to this. Biden was just a friendly-looking person that they could put up front, and then they could make him a puppeteer, ventriloquist dummy, and at some point remove him and put in who they really want. Because I don't think Biden's had a principle in his whole life, and he's been a typical career politician, corrupt as anything. And by the way, we've got pictures of Biden in the 1970s as a senator meeting with Mugabe's ZANU-PF and embracing them and supporting Mugabe's revolution in Zimbabwe. So, you know, he's that kind of person. And by the way, Biden's also on record saying back in 1975, he doesn't see why any South Vietnamese should be brought to America. He doesn't care if they're allies. He doesn't think we need to be one single one of them over here. It doesn't matter what they did for America or what will happen to them if they stay in Vietnam. It's none of our problem, not our concern. So he's a callous man. And somebody was referring to these hideous things going on, and he makes a joke about it. It's absolutely hideous. So right now, even the liberal Democrat supporters of Biden are turning against him, because this is such a debacle. And apparently he doesn't know, but either he doesn't know or doesn't understand, or the people around him have been deliberately lying, shielding him to present this, and it's for a big agenda. You can be sure they've prepped whoever's his replacement, but he's not going to see through his 4 years in office. I think that's pretty clear. I mean, I don't think he even knows who's his wife is, or where he is sometimes.
I'm putting it away from the war a bit. How many American soldiers were pulled out?
Of where? Afghanistan. As far as I know, they were down to something like 2,000.
Yeah, 2,500.
And they're having to almost put in more right now to help with the pullout because it's such a mess. It would have been so easy if they just, we're going to do this over the next few months or weeks or whatever, and then move to background base, and the last to leave should be the US forces on the last plane out. But all the civilians should have been ready. You know, if they had to pull out, they could have done an orderly way and also handing over all the different comms and whatever it is to the Afghan National Army, so alternative arrangements can be made. But to pull out in this way, it was designed to destroy the Afghan National Army. There's no other solution.
That reminds me.
Yes, 100%. Okay.
No, I just said that they even, in order to service or to run some of the planes, they had to actually have like video calls with American engineers who they had withdrawn. And the Americans didn't even allow their subcontractors to service the Afghan planes. They removed the whole supply chain, everything, and they
yes.
didn't want to transfer their contractors.
Away. Yes. So if you ask the average American, do you support us withdrawing our soldiers from Afghanistan? I think the majority would say yes. If you said, would you support us leaving a skeleton group for logistical support, not for combat activity, most would say yes. What's being done is not withdrawing combat troops. It's been withdrawing the support troops, the logistical people that were helping the whole Afghan National Army to function. And the morale a breakdown of all this is shattering. So I can only think this is what they wanted to do. In fact, there's a South African journalist in Afghanistan who was being interviewed by Tucker Carlson. She said, this has to be the result that the White House wanted. Because it was so obvious what is happening here was going to happen like this, that you can only assume that this chaos that's happening now is exactly what they aimed at. Because that was the only option that could come out of these policies and actions.
Joe Biden, when he ran for president, one of his complaining things was that he's a guru on foreign politics and he's got all these connections and years of experience and so forth. And it's almost as if that's backfired him in his face and now it can be used against him because everything he was used for his complaint is turning against his own. So there's definitely a bigger agenda on him to get him out.
Yeah. No, the knives are out for Biden right now. His own allies are turning against him, so I would say he's going down in flames. This almost looks like what they did to Nixon, except Nixon didn't do anything wrong compared. I mean, he had some people spying on his opposition. That happens in politics all the time. They're all spying on one another. Obama was spying on everybody against American constitutional rules and so on, too. So there's a lot of spying. So you think they made an absolute lynch mob to get rid of Richard Nixon over something not even 1% as serious as what's going on now with Biden, Kamala Harris presidency. This is treason what's been going on now. They've abandoned thousands of American and tens of thousands of allied people, civilians, in harm's way. Whoever withdraws the military before they withdrew the civilians from a war zone, it's just incomprehensible. This is treason of a high order. He shouldn't just be impeached. He should be held for treason. And so should the entire administration. Because let's face it, the president doesn't make these decisions alone. There's a whole group of advisors and everything else. So he's part of the deep state. And he's always been part of the deep state. So the people involved in this is so treacherous. And also, by the way, as you should have noticed, the evidence has come out now conclusively. He's not a legitimate president. They didn't win. The audit of votes in Arizona alone has proved there was colossal fraud and mountains of fraud. So, in fact, the entire group involved in the Democratic National ticket should be on trial for fraud and treason, actually.
Could you elaborate a bit on that? So, when this was
asked. This is coming out already. Arizona and others, there's quite a few states who are doing an actual audit of every vote made and matching up, and they're finding that there's hundreds of thousands of votes for Trump that were attributed to Biden, and once they're following the actual paper trail of the votes and so on and so forth, it's been proven that Arizona, which was put over as a blue state, was actually a red state and so on and so forth. So all of this proves that, in fact, Trump got more votes, he won more electoral college votes. He should have actually been the president, and Biden shouldn't be. So it's a fraud which they stampeded people into through colossal fraud and with media collusion.
Who's driving the law? It's just interesting.
The local legislatures or senators.
Really?
Yeah. In, so you've got different groups in those states. So this is not nationwide, but this is done in different states. But remember, it's just a few states that were the swing states. And what this is doing is it's showing a pattern of fraud. Huge fraud. You know, for example, you saw those graphs where Biden's votes are going like this, Trump's votes are going like that, and suddenly Biden's votes went 90 degrees up, and suddenly you've got a dump of votes that were all for Biden. Just wow. And then you look at them, many of those votes that came in were not folded. Now, to vote, you've got to fold it in an envelope or fold it to put it in. You can't have an unfolded ballot. I mean, all of us voted too, and that's true in America. There's got to be a fold. There's no folds. There's a whole lot of these with no creases at all. It's just obviously just printed and dumped in. So the audits are finding out all these kinds of frauds or wrong numbers or people, you know, the dead voting early and often and so on. It's a funny thing is I've seen people with bumper sticks in America for years, things like my grandfather always voted Republican until he died. Since then, he's voted Democrat every time. And I mean, that's so well known, even before 2020, that the Democrats were a bunch of crooks who did a lot of fraud. We know that in South Africa, too. 1994 elections in South Africa, we had officially 650,000 white South Africans boycott the election and didn't vote. But we had 104% voter turnout in 94 elections, according to IEC. That's pretty impressive. 104% when you've got a huge boycott move too. So I don't know how to do that, but commies can do that. And then they found whole containers. Containers, 20-foot containers, filled with IEC ballot boxes unopened after the election. They just incinerated them. Because there were obviously more votes cast and were counted, and there were more votes than there were people in the country, and so they just had to get rid of a whole lot.
This is a comment. I was thinking as you were sharing this about the trustworthiness of nations or not. What does it take for a nation to be trustworthy? And even where you have a leader, I mean, in the States, it's 4 to 8 years for a given president, and then he's replaced. And that can change from nation to nation, whether it's for life or so on. But it really, it's a powerful illustration as you just stack some of the stories together to even think through, as God says, those who put their trust in kings, those who put their trust in rulers and horses as their mind, they will go down. I mean, it's amazing just to think, even within a nation that has strong stands in other parts of the world, overnight that can change. Is our trust in the nation, or is it elsewhere?
Yeah.
But it's quite a powerful testament to the changing.
Yes. So the middle verse of the Bible, if you didn't know, absolutely middle of the Bible is Psalm 118, verse 8 and 9. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put your trust in man. It's better to put your trust in the Lord than to put your trust in princes. Now that is in the heart of the Bible, right in the middle of Psalm 118, verse 8 and 9. So this goes back 3,000 years. It's better to trust in the Lord than to trust in leaders, politicians, princes, kings, whatever you want to call it, presidents. And Jesus is the King of Kings, and he's the Lord of Lords. And every leader should be taught to fear God. Now, when the Queen of England is crowned or king, they're presented with the Bible. This is the most precious thing the world possesses. This is, and there's a whole line of things, you know, counsel, wisdom, statutes. And so, and the monarch of Great Britain has to swear to uphold all the laws of God and to govern according to the gospel of Christ and the laws of God as contained in the Bible. So it's good to put leaders and warn them to fear God and to know his law and to enact it, because they will be judged with greater strictness. Because to whom much is given, much is required. To whom much more is given, much more is required. And that should also be so for voters, and especially people in a free country, they've got the vote, they've got a great country, such as our friends in America have got a very great country. It's done a lot of very great things and a lot of good things, and still does good things in terms of missions and so on. But it should warn us that evil people come and gain control over Christian countries, as has happened in Britain, in South Africa, Rhodesia, all over. We are being ruled by those who hate us, which is one of the judgments of God mentioned in Deuteronomy 28. One of the blessings of obedience is peace and victory and all that. But one of the curses of disobedience, well, amongst the curses, and it's hard to read through the whole of Deuteronomy 28 because after verse 15 it gets really rough. It gets even rougher and rougher and rougher, the diseases. But your enemies will rule over you. And the treacheries that's been done, it just shows, unfortunately, there's a lot of people, bear in mind, I've met Christians, lots of Christians, who smugly, arrogantly, looking down on me, contemptuously, say, I've never voted. You know, and people my age or older saying, I've never voted in an election. And I feel they're more spiritual because they haven't voted. And this is the problem. More than half of the people eligible to vote don't vote. And they say, what difference can my vote make? Well, all the difference. If you could get the people who don't vote to vote, they could outweigh all the people who did vote. Could make all the difference in the world. But this idea that, well, what difference does my light or my salt or my witness or... And if we are teaching children from the earliest, be people of honor. I mean, remember, I still got an old school education. People of integrity, sports, learn to work as a team, to win graciously, to lose graciously, to play by the rules, to respect others, to always congratulate the one who won, you know, even the one who beat you. You know, this kind of attitude. And more important to do the right thing than to win and so on. And when you've got this attitude, I remember growing up just thinking, it's unthinkable that our leaders could lie, steal, cheat, and to betray your own people or to betray your allies. Totally unthinkable. And yet, there's generations growing up who think it's okay. What type of people vote for parties that support abortion, pornography, LGBT, perversion, all the rest of it? What kind of people would support that? And yet, the fact is, it's not just the pagans doing it. There's a lot of church-going people, and there's even born-again Christians amongst those people doing it. So we've got to see that some of us are part of the problem. And, you know, we are judged as individuals in heaven. But on earth, we're judged as nations. And so you might be a wicked person in a righteous nation and enjoy the blessings of that. You might be a righteous person in a wicked nation and suffer the droughts and defeats and economic collapse and devalued currencies and so on that goes along with that. So we need to understand that God judges nations on earth and he judges individuals in eternity. And there's this balance. I'm an individual, but I'm also part of a community and part of a nation. And that's why we do National Days of Repentance and March for Life. We're trying to raise our country to a higher standard, voters' guides and so on. And it's important to know that God always says us 7,000 who have never bowed the knee to Baal. And we must be sure we're amongst those that never bow the knee to Baal. And of course in America there are hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, who haven't bowed the knee to Baal and who are faithful. But they are suffering because of a wicked government. And unfortunately the wicked government is there because of apathetic people. And so Plato said 2,400 years ago, the price of apathy in politics is to be ruled by evil men. And so unfortunately there's a lot of people I know who, you know, we meet them all the time. I'm not interested in politics, I say. Well, politics is very interested in you. And even if you're not interested in politics, they'll still tell you how to live your life, whether you can work, when you can work, what you've got to put on your face to prevent you breathing oxygen, closing you down, no church. So they can. So if I don't want to be involved in politics, then I leave the field in the hands of the wicked, and then they get more and more intrusive, and they decide to take my tax money to abort babies. And so at a certain point, we've got to say, well, this verse shows us God is looking for people to stand up and resist. And that's why we call Protestants. We believe in protesting and resisting against evil. We stand for something better. Any other comments? I know this has been a very big, long presentation tonight, but it's a monumental turning point in history. I tell you, If you live to be 100, you'll remember 2021 when this happened. This is one of those epoch events, like the fall of Saigon 1975, but I think this is worse.
So why do you believe that? What is the worst outcome that is in terms of like a 50-year time frame that we're going to see from this?
Okay, this is akin to the fall of Rome the American Empire, the American Empire's myth of invincibility and so on has been shattered. Okay. It was given a heavy blow in 1975 in Saigon. This is worse, much worse than Saigon 1975. But the treachery involved and the way it's been done, even to its allies like Britain, other NATO powers, this is so bad. I think this can herald an even greater hostility to the West. All the allies made in the Middle East might just say, you know, it's better to get allied with Russia or China or someone else, but Iran, but we can't trust America. The ripple effect of this is going to be hideous. And for missions, just think of all those Christians in Afghanistan, and there are tens of thousands of Christians in Afghanistan. There were, by the way, very, very, very few Christians in Afghanistan before the Russians invaded. And by the way, do you know the Islamic government destroyed the last church in Afghanistan in 1979, just before the Russians invaded. And I've heard Afghans say to me, the Russian invasion was God's judgment on us because we disputed with the people of the book. Well, now there's tens of thousands of Christians in Afghanistan. And what is going to happen to them? This is a very wicked thing. But I think it's heralding a realignment of powers. It's America is at a cataclysmic collapse of international respect, but also internal cohesion. I think the result of this is going to be upheaval, major upheaval. Throughout the Middle East, they're talking about 5 million Afghan refugees who are going to be heading for Europe. That's even more than what they expected after the bombing of Syria and Libya. So the consequences, but what you've just seen is the greatest nation in the world, without any question, suffering not just a humiliating defeat, but a defeat of its own making.
Yeah.
And the president lying about it. And so the compounding factors are so great that I think this will be like, you know, I look back at the most positive event politically in my lifetime was the fall of the Berlin Wall, collapse of the Iron Curtain, the fall of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War. That was epoch making, positively. Yeah. There's other negative ones. In terms of international affairs, I was old enough to remember fall of Saigon 1975, but that was not nearly as traumatic as this one. And that didn't leave as much behind weapons-wise for the Viet Cong as this has done. So you could just see it. This is also telling terrorism works. Keep fighting. It's also telling people who want to be allies of America or fight terrorism, don't even waste your time, you're going to be betrayed. So there's so many things you can talk about on it, but you could just see it. This, it's all negative right now. Unless the people in America take drastic steps. I mean, if they can not just overthrow this government, the ones behind them, and put in a legitimate government, let's face it, this wouldn't have happened under Donald Trump. He told the Taliban their fortune, and they just behaved themselves for 18 months. I mean, phenomenal. That he could do that sort of thing and have that impact. But now they realize, there's nothing they respect more than strength. There's nothing they despise more than weakness. And what you see right now is a weak government. America was respected under Reagan because he is strong, consistent. They respect under Trump because he is strong and consistent. This is like Carter and Clinton and Obama multiplied worse. And I really despise Carter. 13 countries fell under communism under Carter, but this could be even more cataclysmic in its impact. But especially if it leads to a worse than Biden taking over. The point is, will this lead the people of America to repentance and to a united action? We're not thinking the whole nation, but I mean, God said if there's 10 righteous people in Sodom and spirit, I don't know how many people were out of it, what the percentage is. But basically, the principle is there's you don't need the whole nation to repent, but you need a good, solid core of God's people to take them seriously for him to intervene. Why should God intervene? To help and save a nation that kills babies and betrays its allies and thinks it's more important to promote LGBTQ, but they can burn Bibles. You know, I mean, just put those few facts before people, before people say, how could God allow this to happen to us? How could God not? What is holding God back from pouring out his judgment on such a wicked generation? And we could speak about our sins in this country too. We know there's lots, but you know, tonight we're just talking about Afghanistan. I've just taken a short overview of American history in the realm of betrayal. And again, it's not the American people, but it's the U.S. government, especially the deep states, State Department behind that's the worst of this. And I just happen to have met several key people, players who've given me insights into this. So hope this has been beneficial. We'll have it uploaded as a video and as a PowerPoint, and I hope that you can maybe channel some other people's insights to think outside of the box of whatever the media is screaming at people at the moment about this. Mm-hmm.